From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Germany warns Russia risks massive damage in the Ukraine crisis. Is the Crimean dispute affecting the Syrian conflict? An Israeli hospital is treating wounded Syrians.
We don't care where he's from, what he's done, where he's going. He's a patient, he's wounded, he needs help. That's our mission.
And education can help prevent obesity. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says Russia risks massive political and economic damage if it does not change course in the Ukraine crisis. In a speech to the German parliament today, Ms. Merkel said Ukraine's territorial integrity is not up for discussion. The West and Russia have been locked in a tense standoff over Russia's military incursion into Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. At the White House Wednesday, President Obama also warned Russia about interfering in Ukraine.
We will continue to say to the Russian government that if it continues on the path that it is on, then not only us, but the international community, the European Union and others will be forced to apply a cost to Russia's violations of international law and its encroachments on Ukraine. There's another path available, and we hope that President Putin is willing to seize that path. If he does not, I'm very confident that the international community will stand strongly behind the Ukrainian government in preserving its unity and its territorial integrity.
Mr. Obama spoke alongside interim Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk.
Mr. President, it's all about the freedom. We fight for our freedom, we fight for our independence, we fight for our sovereignty, and we will never surrender.
President Obama also took the opportunity of Wednesday's meeting with Mr. Yatsenyuk to reiterate U.S. opposition to the planned Sunday referendum, in which the people of Crimea will get the chance to decide if they want to break away from Ukraine and become part of Russia.
We completely reject a referendum patched together in a few weeks with Russian military personnel basically taking over Crimea. We reject its legitimacy. It is contrary to international law. It is contrary to the Ukrainian constitution.
Earlier Wednesday, leaders of the Group of Seven leading industrialized nations said it will not recognize the Crimean referendum. The G7, which includes Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the United States, also called on Russia to, in their words, cease all efforts to change the status of Crimea contrary to Ukrainian law. How is the Ukrainian crisis affecting the Middle East region, including the vital issues of the Syrian conflict and Iran nuclear negotiations? For answers, VOA's Doug Bernard went to Aaron David Miller, a distinguished scholar with the Wilson Center.
Mr. Miller, how is the Ukrainian conflict affecting the ongoing Syrian civil war and the efforts to rid the government there of its chemical weapons?
Well, at the moment, probably has no appreciable effect. I mean, the reality is that Russian and American cooperation on Syria and on Iran was always a tactical cooperation. The Russians interceded primarily because they wanted to stop an American unilateral military strike. They care much less about Assad's chemical weapons, and certainly even less about pressuring him to into a position where he would essentially be eliminated from power as a consequence of some political arrangement on which the opposition would take over. So it was always, at best, a tactical cooperation. I suspect on the chemicals, the Russians will do enough, push the Syrians far enough to preempt any possibility of another American military strike. But in view of Ukraine, are not going to be terribly cooperative in expeditiously forcing the Syrians to abide by the strict letter of the U.S.-Russia framework agreement.
And do you think at this point the government of Bashar al-Assad may start dragging its feet even more, either with regard to chemical weapons or perhaps other ongoing efforts, humanitarian efforts, peace negotiations, that sort of thing?
They don't need an incentive or an inducement to do that. But yeah, I think the Syrians will make a calculation. The calculation will be based on how much pressure they are under and how much they have to calibrate their response in order to avoid what they what they really do want to prevent, which is a unilateral American military action, or certainly a cooperative action by the West. To the degree to which we are not cooperating with the Russians because of a deep freeze in response to their reassertion of control, perhaps even sovereignty over Crimea and maybe even other parts of Ukraine, I think any hope or help that we should expect from the Russians on this isn't going to be forthcoming.
Also, to the issue of Iran, Russia was also a player there on nuclear negotiations. How do you see, if at all, the Iranians perhaps trying to take advantage of that discord now between the U.S. and Russia?
Well, I think the Iranians will make a calculation based on the internal logic of their negotiations with the P5 plus one, particularly the United States. If, in fact, a comprehensive agreement serves their interests, they'll go ahead and conclude it, regardless of what the Russians want or what they don't want. I think the Russian angle will become important if diplomacy breaks down, because there, I think, if, in fact, we're still in this deep freeze and we have sustained sanctions against Putin and Russia, I think that the Russian capacity to try to undermine P5 plus unity with the Chinese. Remember, the Russians have never been as allergic to the idea of Iran's putative nuclear weapons capacity or even the weapon itself as we are. So they don't have the kind of urgency. They don't see the imperative of pressing really hard on this one, and nor do the Chinese. So I suspect that Russian cooperation with sanctions will weaken. I think the Russians will do everything they can, and they can do a lot, since they're permanent members of the Security Council, to block any authorization to use force resolution there. So they'll become an even more uncooperative partner. But remember, these were long shots, Iran, Syria, anyway. Finally, I think Ukraine will, you know, small powers read great ones very closely, particularly during crisis. And you'll see how any number of powers, smaller powers, Syria, North Korea, Egypt, and Israel, will watch how we respond to Ukraine and to Putin and take our measure accordingly.
So lastly, there's a lot of concern that this Ukrainian conflict may destabilize Russia. What I hear you saying is that there's real potential, perhaps, for destabilization in the Middle East as well.
Well, it's already destabilized. I mean, you have a region, you have a full-blown civil war in Syria. You have Iran that is now in a negotiation, but clearly has the capacity, should they choose to use it, to become a nuclear weapons threshold state or weaponize themselves. You have an Arab-Israeli conflict that shows slim prospects of being comprehensively resolved. So, the Middle East is a mess. The Ukrainian piece of it and the Russian angle will make an already complicated issue that much worse. I don't think you can talk about fundamental additional destabilization. It's an unhappy situation, and it's going to get unhappier.
Aaron David Miller with the Wilson Center and a former advisor to Republican and Democratic U.S. Secretaries of State. Recent unrest in Ukraine has brought more attention to the different Ukrainian-American communities throughout the United States. One of the largest, in the western part of the state of Pennsylvania, is made up of both new immigrants and descendants of those who made a new life in America during the last century. Kane Faribault reports for VOA Television, though the unrest in their home country is 8,000 kilometers away, the tension and turmoil are affecting their lives and relationships in their local communities.
The Ukrainian American community in western Pennsylvania is steeped in tradition. And closely connected to their home country.
They could probably trace about 100,000 people, roughly, in the western Pennsylvania who have some Ukrainian heritage identity.
Timothy Thompson leads the congregation at St. Mary's Ukrainian Orthodox Church in the Pittsburgh suburb of McKees Rocks. He says about 10 to 15,000 immigrants came to the area in the 1990s after the breakup of the Soviet Union.
They came here for jobs, plus churches were sponsoring them, you know, when the Soviet Union first collapsed, when Ukraine declared its independence.
So you have the whole experience of what it is to be Ukrainian in America?
Father Steve Repa is the leader of St. Peter and Paul Ukrainian Orthodox Church in Carnegie, Pennsylvania.
Word everywhere and fills all things.
Repa, a second-generation Ukrainian-American, says old-world resentments between Ukrainians and Russians are still present in some parts of their new communities.
We grew up as first generations with a lot of prejudice. You know, they brought in communism, they brought in death, they killed a lot of people.
He says time has helped some of that prejudice fade. So has proximity. His Ukrainian Orthodox Church stands right next to the Holy Virgin Russian Orthodox Church, and members of the two churches routinely interact.
They're not Russians. Like, technically, we're not Ukrainians. They're Americans of Russian descent. They have no connection to Putin or what he does or what they want him to do.
Father Timothy's church in McKees Rocks stands in the shadow of the gray onion domes of St. Nicholas Russian Orthodox Church, a block away. He says the block that separates them is about as close as their two communities get.
Simply because of the fact of when our grandparents founded these churches, they knew they were Ukrainian and not Russian, so they chose not to be part of those Russian Orthodox churches. That's why they founded Ukrainian Orthodox churches.
Father Timothy, whose wife is from Ukraine, says regardless of when they left, most Ukrainian Americans have a close connection to their home country, and the Russian military intervention there has deepened the historic divide.
I wouldn't walk across the street to say hello to them right now. I mean, if I'm around them, I'm going to be cordial and respectful, and I'm sure they'll be the same.
VOA reached out to members of the Russian Orthodox community, but they declined to be interviewed. But Father Timothy points out their differences usually end at the church doors.
It's political. We all commune from the same chalice.
It's that common ground the Ukrainian-American community looks for as they pray for peace and continued independence for all parts of their home country. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
The Palestinian Islamic Jihad group in the Gaza Strip says an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire has gone into effect, aimed at halting a two-day flare-up of rocket attacks into Israel and Israeli airstrikes on the Palestinian enclave. Islamic Jihad leaders said the agreement for calm was a renewal of understandings reached in 2012 in Cairo, referring to a truce that ended an eight-day Gaza war 2 years ago. Minutes before the Palestinian group posted word of the truce on Facebook, Israeli aircraft struck at Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip near the Egyptian border, wounding three Palestinians. The Israeli military said that seven terror sites had been hit. Hours earlier, sirens sounded in the southern Israeli towns of Ashkelon and Ashdod, warning of incoming rockets. Rockets landed in open areas, causing no casualties, but flew deeper into Israel than Wednesday's attacks in southern border towns. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, who is based in the West Bank, condemned the military escalation in and around Gaza, including rocket fire on Israel, during a news conference in Bethlehem. On Wednesday, the Israeli military carried out nearly 30 airstrikes and fired tank shells at suspected militant targets in Gaza after Islamic Jihad launched more than 50 rockets towards Israel, and the heaviest such barrage in nearly 2 years. The rocket fire, which police said caused no casualties, came a day after Israel killed three Islamic Jihad members in a Gaza airstrike. Of the hundreds of thousands of Syrian casualties from Syria's three-year civil war, more than 700 wounded have been treated in neighboring Israel, despite the long-standing conflict between the two countries. VOA Scott Bob reports on one such case from the Western Galilee Hospital in northern Israel.
Three-year-old Mariam from Syria has been at Nahariya Hospital for nearly a month. Her father, Ahmed, is explaining why. For their protection, we cannot show their faces or use their real names.
At 6 o'clock, they shelled us with a bomb. The wounded were taken to the field hospital, and I saw my daughter was wounded in the head and her mother was crying. She is at the hospital since February 19th.
The bomb killed Mariam's twin brother, another innocent victim of the war that has killed 130,000 people. Her father managed to get his daughter into Israel. Mariam was not expected to live. This 600-bed hospital, a few kilometers from the border with Lebanon, has treated more than 200 wounded Syrians, including 70 women and children. Dr. Jean Soustiel says the experience is especially traumatic for those who arrive unconscious.
When they're first opening their eyes, they have to deal with the situation, which is quite frightening for them. If you think about it, the first language that they are hearing is an Hebrew language of their old enemy.
More than 700 Syrian wounded have been treated in Israel, according to the government, many at a military field hospital in the Golan Heights near the Syrian border. When they're better, they return to Syria or go to a refugee camp in Jordan. Dr. Tzvi Sheleg says hospital staff treat Syrians with the same dedication as any other patient.
We don't care where he's from, what he's done, where he's going. He's a patient, he's wounded, he needs help. That's our mission, that's our goal, that's what we do for a living. That's what we do for our heart.
Director Massad Barhoum acknowledges Israel's role is minor compared to the humanitarian efforts of Syria's other neighbors.
It is a drop in the ocean, but it is important even for one person that we relieve his pain or we save his lives.
Staff here say the doctors in Syria are doing heroic work, but desperately need more help from the world community. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Nahariya, Northern Israel.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
In many middle and low-income countries, obesity levels rise along with income. But a new study says the better educated women are, the better their chances of avoiding obesity. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Dr. Amina Etsy-Selmi is the lead author of the University College London study. She wanted to know if trends in high-income countries could be found elsewhere.
We know that in high-income countries, education and income tend to go together, and that those who are most educated and have the highest income tend to be the thinnest, and the opposite being true.
The study looked at the middle-income countries of Egypt, Jordan, and Colombia, and the low-income countries of Nigeria, India, and Benin. These are countries where income levels are on the rise. As a result, women are buying higher-calorie foods. Researchers call them energy-dense foods. Simply put, they can pack on the pounds because they're often laden with sugar, salt, and fat. These can be processed foods, or so-called fast foods.
The study shows that although higher income or higher wealth seems to be correlated with a greater risk of obesity in women in middle-income countries and low-income countries as well, in middle-income countries, something strange happened in that education seemed to start protecting against this effect, so that women with higher education weren't affected by this wealth effect that made other women more obese.
She says there may be a few explanations for this.
It could be that more educated women just have different body shape preferences. They're more in contact with Western images of beauty, which promote thinness. It could also be that they have better health understanding, different time preferences, so they kind of invest in future health.
But the link between education, wealth, and health appears a bit different in low-income countries. It may have to do with past economic conditions, when many types of high-calorie foods were scarce. The desire for those foods now may outweigh the protective education effect seen in middle and high-income countries.
The greater scarcity means that obesity is just not an issue in that kind of environment. Any advantage you might have socioeconomically, whether it's higher education or higher wealth, might be used to be able to access a greater quantity of food. And the market isn't as complex as a middle-income country where you have lots of products and there are lots of decisions to be made, and that's where education may start to kick in as something that helps consumers to make decisions.
Also, low-income countries may not have public health systems in place to deal with growing obesity levels. Obesity has been linked to such non-communicable diseases as cancer, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. Dr. Aitzi Selmi says more study is needed on what she calls the interplay between education and the wider environment.
Interventions could target either the education side of things to encourage women's education or health knowledge. I mean, we need to look in more detail on the pathways that link education to obesity. Or it could be to do with the general environment and the kind of information that is in the environment, and that in some ways puts those who don't have education at a disadvantage because the signals that are coming from the environment might promote unhealthy behaviors like overconsumption.
That environmental information may include multimedia advertisements, which tell consumers fast food is delicious, cheap, and easy to get. They often lack details on the food's nutritional value. She says education can be a good defense against unhealthy food choices.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. If you understand the risks that are around you and how your decisions affect your health, then you'll probably make different decisions.
Aitzi Selmi is a Wellcome Trust Fellow at University College London. The study appears in Plus One. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
From the Empire State Building to Wall Street, the Statue of Liberty and beyond, New York City boasts a huge wealth of world-famous icons. Soon, Rockefeller Center's Radio City Music Hall, an icon all its own, will showcase many of those places in a new show. Heart and Lights is a high-energy love letter to all things New York, featuring huge video screens, giant puppets, and some famous dancers. VOA's Adam Phillips was there for a Heart and Lights rehearsal.
Since 1933, the Rockettes have been thrilling audiences at Radio City Music Hall, billed as the largest indoor theater in the world. For many locals and tourists alike, the Rockettes are New York, and so is this. 9 meters high, this Statue of Liberty is a mere puppet compared to the one in New York Harbor. Still, it's a big puppet that takes a forest of electronic gadgetry to operate.
She's mostly animatronic, but the animatronics and the servos in her are so responsive that the two puppeteers that are controlling her facial features, she responds just like a human face would.
Matt Atchison's team spent 3 years developing the Heart and Lights puppets.
For me, you know, coming from a puppetry background and doing puppet shows in basements and stuff, to now be on the Radio City stage is super exciting.
As a star-struck young girl growing up in the rural South, Katie Walker dreamt of that stage.
I came to New York with a dream. I followed it. I worked hard every day, and I finally achieved it. And every time I perform this show, I feel like I'm a 10-year-old visiting New York City for the first time.
Walker says she and her sister Rockettes enjoy sharing the spotlight with the puppets.
My personal favorite is the Wall Street Bull. He comes to life when you least expect it, and he wants to be a comedian. So he has all these funny little jokes and puns, and I just think it will be so exciting for everyone, from little kids to adults, to see these landmarks of New York City in a whole new light.
The lights, the sound, and the action sizzle and fizzle together at every moment.
One, two.
That takes hundreds of hours of grueling rehearsal for the dancers. But Katie Walker says it's worth it.
Of course, everything is still based on our precision dance training, but it's much more contemporary and modern and much more physical intense, I would say. You know, we've never worked this hard. We've never trained this hard, and it's just taking the Rockette style to an all new level.
Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. Reporting from Washington, I'm Susan Yawkey.